Hi, I'm Grant Bartley from Philosophy Now magazine, and you're listening to the second edition of the Philosophy Now radio show. Tonight we're going to be talking about art. First, I'm going to be considering the new play Wittgenstein, The Crooked Roads, which is on in the Riverside in Hammersmith from the 19th of April. I'll be talking a little with the director, Nick Blackburn, and playing a couple of tracks from the thing itself. And then we're going to have a little studio discussion on the philosophy of art. My studio guests are Mark Robert, who's a teacher in South East London. He's written an article on the forthcoming issue of Philosophy Now, putting forward a Wittgensteinian view of art, which we'll no doubt get into a little bit. Hi, Mark.
Hello there.
And Alex Gaff, who's a freelance anthropologist, such things do exist, and a long-term art enthusiast. Unfortunately, our artists couldn't turn up today, but we're going to have a great time anyway, so I hope you'll enjoy the show. First, we're going to play a track from the sketch from the show. Oh.
Okay. So beautiful. So beautiful in the moonlight. God's silver nitrate photography. If I were God, I would have created the sun. It's too bright and hot, too demanding, driving us on relentlessly. I'd have had only the moon. So then we'd all be lunatics. The real mystery, of course, is not how the world is, but that it is. Give me another moment to savor this while I can. Norman, thank you. Thank Lee for looking after me so well. I know I've been hard on you from time to time. It's because I'm always hardest on those from whom I expect most, from those I love most. But now I must leave. I have to return to Europe. To England. This is not my Ithaca.
Hi, okay, so that was a little bit of the play Wittgenstein, The Crooked Roads, starting next week in the Riverside. Let me tell you, for those who don't know, a bit about Ludwig Wittgenstein. He was an extremely influential philosopher of language of the first half of the 20th century. He was born in Austria, but was based in England when he was doing his philosophy. When I say he was influential, I mean that he was influential twice. In his later life, he repudiated his first views of language. Well, these first views on how language works, to give meaning to our thoughts, were put forward in his infamous book, The Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, in which he thought to start with that he solved all the problems of philosophy. Obviously he didn't. The basic theory here was that language creates pictures of ideas. And he also said that all ideas must be expressible in language, that are expressible in language have a logical form. That is, thought must be logical, but you can't step outside of thought to see logic. You can only express the form of logic and the form of language, as it were. Difficulties with this view led Wittgenstein later into seeing language as a sort of game in which we unreflectively learn the rules of language use as children. In this later view, the meaning of words is how they're used in this language game. This view of language was published posthumously in the Philosophical Investigations from 1953. In that book, not surprisingly, Wittgenstein draws attention to the many different ways the same word can be used. For instance, the different ways in which we can say the word thought is used, and as we're going to be talking a little later, the different ways the word art can be used. One famous quote by Wittgenstein is, "Philosophy is a battle against the bewitchment of our intelligence by means of language." Now, Ludwig Wittgenstein personally was a curious man in many ways. A devout Catholic, he was bisexual. Although his solipsistic intensity hints of degrees of Asperger's to me, he was fond of letter writing and punning and was by many accounts a charismatic figure and teacher. His father was an Austrian steel magnate, but he gave his inherited millions to his brothers and sisters to become first a Trappist monk, that's another contradiction because of his language interests, and then a primary school teacher, which he wasn't very good at. Obsessed with logic, his thoughts ultimately tended to mysticism. He made a life out of thinking about language, but thought the most important things were those things which had to be passed over in silence, the aspects of life which couldn't be communicated. The play Wittgenstein, The Crooked Rose, looks at the somewhat contradictory aspects of this complex life of this complex man. So if we can start talking to Nick. Hi, Nick. How are you?
Hello there. I'm great, thanks.
I've just got a few questions about the play and about Wittgenstein for you here. So first of all, Nick, can you please tell us what the play Wittgenstein is about? I mean, what aspects of Ludwig Wittgenstein does it focus on?
Okay, well, and to start off with, I suppose, kind of another famous quotation by Wittgenstein. I think from relatively late on in his writing, there's that thing where he says, if a lion could talk, we could not understand him. Mm-hmm. And as you were saying before, this idea of, well, how can you ever understand a system without being part of it? And Wittgenstein, The Crooked Rose, is very much about... Wittgenstein is at the centre of it. He's in almost every scene. Uh-huh. But really it is about the people around him and about us that come after him and how he teaches us through his kind of frustrations at how well or how little we can get to understand other people.
Okay.
So it's kind of a play about memory and relationships in that way.
Sure.
And how on earth we can construct that.
All right.
Irresponsible.
Do you concentrate in the play more on the man or on his ideas or an equal mixture of most? And which is the most interesting aspect to you and why?
A lot of it is about... I mean, the man is there. You see him. And you see him over a swathe of kind of from his first meeting with Bertrand Russell to the kind of a few months before his death. So it's uh-huh. happened like sort of 1911 to 1951.
Okay.
And he is very much, and from what we've kind of sort of our own research that we've done as kind of non-professional sort of theatre people as well, it is this sense of someone who lives through their ideas,
yeah,
and that encounters with him are battles with ideas as much as they are with him.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the most dramatically sort of electric scenes in the play, he seems like a bully, but it's never about him and another character. It's never about him and Bertrand Russell kind of fighting, or him and his, we see part of his PhD viva, which is on the tractators, or we see mm-hmm. him with Norman Malcolm, who was kind of an early student of his that became sort of a well-known philosophy professor in his own right, and was one of his kind of, I guess, most loved protégés in a way. And we had a bit of a sort of a late scene there that you heard. And that it's kind of, he can be very cruel and very delightful and very generous, but the thing that often tips that is how serious people are, I suppose, or how mm-hmm. seriously one pursues an idea and respects an idea, even when the articulation of it is beyond us.
Okay, well, we're going to play another snippet here. This is you and the writer discussing the prologue, which is... according to my notes, it's Ludwig Wittgenstein's lack of misogyny, etc. So, here we go.
Now, I imagine it a bit like this, that I'm walking along a corridor going to a lecture on mind and body, and I have under my left arm a pile of books, and under my right arm... a sheaf of lecture notes. And along the corridor comes Wittgenstein, and he sees me, and I stop and say, good morning, and he says, good morning, Bill, what are you up to? And I say, I'm going to a lecture, I'm going to deliver a lecture on mind and body. What is that under your left arm, he says. I say, it's books. What do you need those for? And I said, well, I might need to refer to them, or to recall what it is someone says, or quote from them. What is it under your right arm? Lecture notes. You know, I've prepared them. I've taken days, sometimes weeks, and trying to get things right. And I read them out, and hoping that the wording's right. Bill, that's a disgrace. You'll be just cheating your students. You should. Every lecture should be like putting your life in danger, intellectual danger. It should be de novo, from nothing. You've got to think on your feet. That's the only thing that students will remember, that they're worth remembering, that you were serious and you didn't try to cheat them, that you tried to think seriously and deeply about every problem you approached. Just go away, Bill. I don't understand what you're doing. You shouldn't be doing philosophy. You should go out and do something useful, something sensible. That will do for the moment.
Hi, that was the writer, William Lyons, discussing the play with Nick Blackburn, who's on the phone line talking about the production with me. Now, Nick, what to you is the most interesting thing about directing this production, did you find?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, that's the clip that you just played is actually is Bill, who ran the philosophy department at Trinity College Dublin for many years, talking about a waking sort of fantasy or nightmare that he has about Wittgenstein now, and it feeds into the seriousness that we were talking about before. And in a way, the greatest interest and challenge for me as a director of this piece is similar to his fear of that. We know that we are crafting a play about a figure who would not want a play written by him. But the idea that people are going to dress up and be him and be other people, and we are going to encapsulate a human life in, you know, sort of about 80 minutes in a way that will entertain and interest people. Although actually, he loved Betty Hutton films, he loved cowboy films and detective magazines. And
he was into popular art in a way, wasn't he? But which is quite striking considering the high nature of his philosophy in many ways.
And that was very much part of the culture that he grew up in, I think, and the circles that he continued to, his involvement with the Bloomsbury Group or all of that kind of. He was saturated in all of it, and the architects and sculptors and artists that he admired, he very much admired. And there was a different, but there was a sense of kind of professionality and then life, and that, for example, watching cinema was like, I think he describes it like a shower bath, like after his, it's in there, wonderful recollections of his life.
I know he used to want to go into the theatre and sit in the front row of the cinema so that his total experience would be immersed in the experience of watching the film.
But also that it was really a kind of brainwashing, actual sense of that like something would... I don't know whether it's the same that sort of Francis Bacon talks about, you know, kind of great art unlocking the valves of sensation or that kind of thing. But it really was like, I need to watch drivel now of it will allow me to complete. It's like watching static on the television.
Sort of cleansing the palate of his mind.
Maybe. Literally, yeah.
Okay, what aspects of Wittgenstein's philosophy do you find most compelling or most interesting or even the most significant for our society? If that's not too heavy a question.
I mean, it is for us, but in a way, partly because the philosophy of the investigation is so intertwined with the problems of life in a way, and that idea of language games and our connections with people, I think.
I don't think he wanted to detach philosophy from life. He wanted to make it, you know, it was his life, really, wasn't it?
And it would be very interesting to know more than kind of we have in biographies about the real effect that the specific effects that the First World War had on that you know, kind of the engagement.
Mm-hmm.
That whereas he didn't kind of, you know, philosophize with a hammer, he did. He was very involved, and there's something about the philosophy which is absolutely the work of the man, say, who, while working at a hospital, came up with a tremendous wound ointment, or that had instructions for the improvement of the field telephones he was using mm-hmm. in the trenches, or it's that kind of...
He was a bit of a polymathic genius, I suppose. We're going to play now a track of Bill, the writer, discussing a nightmare about Wittgenstein.
It's the other way around. So this next track that you'll play will be us talking about the differences between the kind of his sort of film script version of the beginning. It's the various ways that we're kind of crafting this beginning of the play, which ends
into it,
really.
All right.
The other thing, it seemed to me filmic in that it's showing, not saying, very little conversation, and a lot of it is him hunched over, engaged in the very last writing he ever did, in fact. Mm. But and it's got a lot of good things about Wittgenstein, the sort of slightly gamey humour that he had about philosophy. You know, that, of course, people think we're mad.
Yeah.
You know, I realise that he's saying, in effect. But then again, his great dedication to sort of austerity in thought and in art, and he often thought that philosophy should be allied to art. He thought of himself as creating a new style of literary philosophizing through sharp, curt images and aphorisms, and here he's actually engaging in an artistic endeavor when he looks at Mrs. Bevan's coat and realizes that, you know, the buttons are superfluous. Mm-hmm. And they ruin the nice lines. And remember, he's a follower of Adolf Wallace. Mm. And ornament is excrement. So he proceeds to cut. But she also sees it, like she has the insight at the same time. She sees that it is better.
Yeah.
And that gives him great pleasure.
It's one of the the only. Of interactions that he has with a woman, actually.
Is that too, yeah. Except for Lady Otterley.
Yeah. But
whom he ignores.
And in a way, they're two different kind of violent sort of things towards women, isn't it? It's a kind of...
Yeah. He's been accused of misogyny by many people. And and Miss Anscombe, people say, oh, what about Miss Anscombe? You know, but he used to think of her as male. And sometimes referred to as my man or something like that. So you know, that doesn't reinforce the opposite case all that well.
Yeah.
But she was also a very good philosopher, so you know, he took notice of people who were very good, no matter what gender or animal they might be. So she earned her place alongside the rest. But he was very much a creature of his time in many respects.
Sounds like we got the order of tracks a bit mixed up there, never mind. But, Nick, I've just got a couple more questions to ask you. I mean, this one is, what sort of experience are you hoping the audience will have on watching the play, and what do you hope they'll take away with them from watching the play?
Well, I want them to feel quite... I think they'll feel quite awake during it when mm-hmm. not sort of, you know, kind of lulling you into the darkness and telling you a story, although there is an element of that in sort of any play. That we're really engaging, and we're engaging the audience in the challenges of showing and not saying,
mm-hmm.
That Bill was talking about there, that ultimately, and this is the sort of the kind of the human version of that kind of, you know, of that which we cannot speak, we must pass over in silence.
Yeah.
That sometimes one really only understands something by pointing to it rather than describing it. We're also actually, we've become quite interested in, probably in a kind of our own idiosyncratic way, in this, the kind of the sort of earlier ideas that also Russell was investigating about kind of simple objects, and when one object stands for another object, and all that kind of, and a lot of the way that we're doing this is in terms of kind of impersonation, and also using kind of simple objects in the play to two actors as a variety of different things, although that's, you know...
So you're sort of showing the nature of a life by showing Wittgenstein's life? Would that be a fair comment, do you think?
And also showing the failings and inadequacies of trying to do that.
Uh-huh.
That it's kind of all right, and it's all right to know that there are things which professionally one cannot achieve, which in a more kind of feeling sort of non-professional way one can kind of get to and understand. I say this because it's interesting that William Lyons, the writer, was very keen to kind of point out sort of earlier on in this that he is not, although he is a philosopher, he's not writing this as a philosopher, that it is almost kind of another, it's sort of another life and another kind of voice. And I think that's very much something which involves the characters in the play, people like Russell, who had the sort of, an almost a film star celebrity life, which Wittgenstein disapproved of. But, so that kind of...
That kind of vibe, yeah. There are obviously philosophical implications. Like, there are limitations to what you can demonstrate about somebody's life, which would be very in tune with, I guess, a lot the essence of Wittgenstein's thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Before we play a final track, which is Sylvester McCoy, who plays the older Wittgenstein in the multimedia production, who, I should say for viewers, was one of the Doctor Who's. May I just ask you, is there anything else you'd like to tell us about the play? When's it start? How much does it cost? You know, that sort of thing.
It starts at 7:30 in the evening. It lasts about 80 minutes.
From the 19th of...
From Tuesday, yes.
Till when?
Until the 8th of May.
In the Riverside, which is in Hammersmith.
It's on Crisp Road, and tickets are between £10 and £15.
Okay, that's great. Oh, thanks a lot, Nick. Here's the final track.
Lovely.
Well, with the prologue and the stage direction.
And take it quite... Really take this one kind of quite slowly.
Yes.
Particularly the speaking bit. I can hold it sort of here.
Oh, that's better, I can see it better. Shall I start?
Yes.
Prologue. Garden in Dr. Bevan's house, Cambridge, March 1951. Ludwig Wittgenstein. Now in his early 60s and afflicted with severe cancer, has gone to Cambridge to seek treatment from a Dr. Bevan, who has been recommended by his friend, Con Drury. His health has deteriorated so fast that soon after his arrival, he is in effect a terminally ill patient in Dr. Bevan's home. Wittgenstein. I'm sitting with the philosopher in the garden. He says again and again, I know that that's a tree. Pointing to a tree that is near us. Someone else arrives and hears this, and I tell him, this fellow isn't insane. We are only doing philosophy. A bird in the branches of a tree nearby begins to sing. Wittgenstein stops writing and listens.
Okay, so listeners in Radio Space, I hope that's whetted your appetite for going to see some theatrical philosophy at the Riverside starting from next week. Okay, we're going to soon go into the studio discussion about art, but first I want to play a beautiful song just to introduce the idea of beauty. This is Song to the Siren. Hi, this is the Philosophy Now radio show. I'm Grant Bartley, and that was a Song to the Siren by This Mortal Coil. We're going to be talking now to Mark Roberts and to Alex Gath about art. So first of all, we've got Mark Roberts, who's written an article called Let's Abolish Art in the forthcoming issue of Philosophy Now magazine. And in which he puts forward a particular view of art. So if I could ask you to summarise your view in that article, please, Mark.
Certainly, yes. As a matter of fact, I was very interested in what Nick Blackburn said about Wittgenstein's taste in popular films.
Uh-huh.
And I would cross my mind whether he had ever seen the Laurel and Hardy films. I presume he must have done.
Yeah.
Because I think there's quite a lot of dialogue in... I'm speaking as a member of the Laurel and Hardy Appreciation Society, uh-huh. I hasten to say. And I think quite a lot of the dialogue written by Stan Laurel would have interested him. A particular phrase I remember, one of the films, Stan Laurel says, "I know what I meant. I knew what I meant, but I couldn't say it."
Oh, that's very Wittgenstein.
I think he might have repaid some Wittgensteinian analysis. And, of course, there's their famous phrase, which... Ollie Hardy says, "Here's another fine mess you've got me into."
Mm-hmm.
And I think Wittgenstein said much the same thing when he talked about his... he said in the philosophical investigations, he said that the aim of his philosophy was to show the fly the way out of the fly bottle. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine him saying, "Here's another fly bottle you've got me trapped in." Mm-hmm. Rather like Ollie Hardy.
Okay, so how does this relate to your view on art, then?
Well, the word art and all the debate and argument about it seems to me to be a very good example of a fly caught in a fly bottle. I mean, the philosophers are the flies buzzing around in the fly bottle because there seem to be so many different ways of defining art. And, in fact, one edition of Philosophy Now was devoted mainly to this question.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it really came out with any clear answer at the end of it. So my aim in this article was to try and see how we could... You know, what was the real reason for this problem over the word art?
Uh-huh.
And, in fact, I'm interested also... That you,
mean, you mean the fact that there doesn't seem to be a particular definition of
yes,
art?
Yes, exactly, and that art nowadays seems to cover so many things. For example, you know, pickled dogs and unmade beds and sharks and so on, and, you know, that's meant to cover the same thing as a constable... view of stuff. You know,
okay,
Hayway,
so what was
so
your
on.
What is your sort of response or solution
well,
to this problem?
I was interested in, particularly in one of Wittgenstein's close associates, who you were just mentioning, Elizabeth Anscombe, because she was dealing with a rather similar problem about moral mm-hmm. concepts, and she was puzzling about what we mean by ought. And it seemed to me rather parallel to the debate about what we mean by art. And her conclusion about the meaning of ought was that ought was a concept which had somehow survived outside its natural context, and that it had first come into use during the years when Christianity was dominant, and more recently, well, in those days, God was seen as the lawgiver who ultimately determined what ought to be done, and that's mm-hmm. what was meant by ought. But gradually, for better or worse, among philosophers, that belief gradually declined.
Okay, how does this relate to art?
But the word ought continued in use. Well, it seems to me that art, the same thing has happened to the word art,
uh-huh.
that it's it actually came into use as a separate concept in the 18th century, and the range of particular arts became separated off and known as the fine arts. That was poetry, painting, sculpture, architecture, and music. And they were adopted as a special category called the fine arts, and they were highly prestigious and became more prestigious pursuits over the next century, whereas before that time, arts and crafts were more or less interchangeable words. There was no such thing, really, as art in the sense, the rather the present meaning of art, where it's regarded with great respect and almost as a holy thing, you know, to be an artist or to create a work of art. Whereas in those days, it was just another craft. You know, an artist was the same as an artisan. The two words were more or less interchangeable. So you would be, in those days, before the 18th century, it would be quite normal to say that a wheelwright or a shoemaker was an artist.
Okay.
Just so, as much as a painter or a composer.
So the word art is quite artificial. Now, Alex, as a philosopher and an anthropologist, I mean, what's your take on what the meaning of the word art is?
I agree that there's a worry about it along the lines of what Mark says, because I think that if it changes and people start to feel that they're uncertain about whether they're using it appropriately,
mm-hmm.
then you might start to get, and you do, in my opinion, start to get a emperor has no clothes phenomenon, where some people seem to be using the word art in contexts where other people are not entirely convinced that it should be used,
uh-huh.
and they may be persisting in it because, to use Mark's idea, they are flies buzzing around in a fly bottle, but other people are not really very happy with it, but feel they have to go along with it because the emperors appear to be saying, or the emperor's courtiers, that you now have to use the word art, even though other people are not actually happy with it.
Okay, so you both seem to have this agreement that the word art doesn't have any one particular meaning. But if we go back to Ludwig Wittgenstein's view of language a bit, he had this view of words in which words had the same word would have different sorts of meanings, but they would bear a sort of family resemblance to each other. Now, is there not a family resemblance in the meaning of the word art? Who would like to answer that, Mark or Alex?
Well, it's very difficult to see a family resemblance between pickled dogs and Constable landscape. You know, it really is stretching things very, very far. And you know, the solution I put forward is that, you know, which may seem impracticable, but this is the same solution that Elizabeth Anscombe mm-hmm. proposed for the word ought, and that is that we should try to stop using the word art in its present
yeah.
sense and try and revert to the use of arts before the 18th century, where it was just like a craft. In fact, try and get back to the state where art and craft were just interchangeable words.
Okay.
And in fact, I conclude the article by quoting Dylan Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
In one of his best-known poems, he described his work as my craft or art.
All right.
And that would be a very good example for us to follow.
Okay, let me try this definition of art, then. It's something art is something non-functional or the non-functional aspect of something which is intended to convey information. What do you think about that, Alex? Do you think that's a good definition?
No.
Why not?
Because I don't think the word information is very illuminating in that
uh-huh.
context. It simply begs the question, what is the information and why do you want to have it?
Well, it could mean any idea that's supposed to be conveyed from one person to another, for instance.
Well, I think I would challenge that beautiful art does actually convey information. I think in the first instance it causes an emotional response more than it conveys information.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the question that Mark's point of view raises that most occurs to me is that if a old use of a word becomes discredited, it doesn't follow that you can't sort of resurrect something of a new sense or a new use
uh-huh.
of it. An obvious example would be the word law, which
right.
originally was moral law and God's law, and then subsequently became scientific laws.
Uh-huh.
And so words can be adapted and find a valuable new role.
So how would you adapt the word art then?
Now that's the question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I think that Mark's suggestion about linking it more closely to crafts rather than to so-called high arts is entirely reasonable, and I agree with it. But I think that with regard to the arts that get into Tate Modern and other such places, we're probably going to have to tolerate dispute. I think that we're not going to be able to either ban the word or adjudicate about what gets in there. That's a slightly uncomfortable conclusion, but I think it's the reality.
Okay, would you like to respond to that, Mark?
Well, I quite agree that you can't ban words, but I think if, you know, we're trying to do philosophy, then we should be trying to clarify in our minds what these words mean, if anything.
Mean to who?
To us, to anybody, to ourselves or to...
To the person using it, yeah.
Yes, and unfortunately, you know, we've reached a stage now where art has become more or less meaningless. In fact, you know, I've got a special...
The word art rather than the actual thing, yeah?
Oh, yes, the word. And I'd just like to quote a brief sentence from Andy Warhol, mm-hmm. perhaps a notorious person, but anyway, he said, art is whatever you can get away with. Art is whatever you can get away with. And, you know, how much... You can't get any more cynical than that, can you?
OK, well, that brings us nicely to the next track, which is Andy Warhol by David Bowie. This is Grant Bartley from Philosophy Now magazine. You're listening to the Philosophy Now radio show. We're talking about art here. That was David Bowie, Andy Warhol. And so the next question I want to ask my guests is, what is beauty and how far is it relative to culture? Do you have any views on that, Alex?
I do, yes. I think that beauty is in part motivated by what people naturally respond to. So it has to do with the history of the human species. That's to say, sunsets and beautiful landscapes and nice sounds and so on, which appeal to our ears. So these things...
Why do they appeal, I think, would be the question there.
Well, probably originally, because nice sunsets... correlate with nice weather and mm-hmm. so on. I mean, practical things like that. But one then becomes conditioned, or the species does, to like those things and find them reassuring and comforting.
So you've got basically evolutionary view of beauty, that we've sort of connect our ideas of beauty with what we've evolved to like or appreciate. Or
I think that's at the origin. It then gets much more complicated because people have individual tastes that vary, of course.
Okay, how does that work? How do the tastes differ from the instincts?
Well, that's partly
to
do with people's different life histories, so uh-huh. that you like different landscapes according to where you've been brought up and so on, probably.
Okay.
But it also has to do with their idiosyncrasies, and people have different hearing responses according to whether they've got perfect pitch and so on. So different pieces of music appeal to them, whether they like high notes and low notes, and so sopranos and tenors and so on.
That's a culture... nurture rather than nature,
I suppose.
I mean, would you like to add anything to that, Mark? What's your view of what beauty is?
Well, beauty is an entirely subjective, largely subjective idea. Mm-hmm. As Alex is saying, can apply to sights or sounds. It's an approval word. Uh-huh. And to that extent, it's an emotive word, which is to that extent very
you're
hard
saying
to,
when you're saying something
define,
is
you know?
Beautiful, you think it's just somebody saying, right, I really like this, or is there any other information that they're trying to add when they say that sort of thing?
Well, no doubt many people would be able to explicate that further, you know, and give reasons for their opinion. And that's, and I think the art, let's avoid that word, but the skill of a good critic would be to explain why certain things are beautiful and perhaps why others aren't. Mm-hmm. But I think that's the nearest one can get to defining it, you know.
Okay.
I'm sorry, that's probably not very helpful, but...
Well, that's a start, isn't it? But, modern art doesn't seem particularly concerned with beauty. It seems more concerned with how clever the concept behind its construction is. What do you think art loses by having this different concept that's moved away from the idea of making something beautiful into making something clever or new?
I think there is a problem there because... it means that one of the things that happens is that there can be an overstatement of the value of novelty, so that every artist has to be novel for its own sake, mm-hmm. and also they have to build up something of a cult of personality, so that their novelty has to be the kind of fashionable and marketable novelty, and this means that every time you go to an exhibition or see a display of art, you have to be confronted with X number of artists' attempt to be novel and provocative. And that's fine some of the time, but my goodness, it can be terribly wearing.
Yeah.
And you want a little bit of beauty there as well.
Well, I would say so, but the consensus of the cognoscenti of the art market seems to be rather that it's more involved in theory than in the technique or skill or taste of the artist. I mean, how far is the modern concept of art different from previous cultures' views of beauty and what makes good art?
I think that the view that every artist has to strike out in a new direction and be individual, novel and provocative is unusual. I think most cultures seem to have a kind of artistic canon which people draw upon and in a certain sense recreate. And in fact, when you look at art in other cultures, it can seem shocking to us how perhaps conservative they are, and we don't understand that conservatism that mm-hmm. you reproduce things rather similar to what has gone before.
Okay, so the paradigm for art these days is just novelty rather than this is what we've conceived of art before, so this is what we continue to conceive of art. But it seems to me that paradigm, this idea of art being good art being what is novel seems to be itself a particular idea of art. Now, where do we go from there in the art world, do you think?
Well, I may sound like a voice from the dark ages, but uh-huh. I really think that as I've said before, that the word art has now reached a ridiculous stage, you know, really almost a reductio ad absurdum where...
What does that mean? Sorry, well, can you explain that to the listeners?
Well, it's been pushed to the limits beyond which it makes any sense at all. You know, when the Tate Modern buys some tins of, you know, what I politely call manure from somebody, and that is supposed to be, work of art, you know, I think if that is taken seriously, then art is a redundant concept, really, and that's really the point I've been trying to make in my article.
I mean, I'm not an art curator by any means, but I think the response to that would be you've got an old-fashioned view of art, and the art market has moved on, or the view of art has moved on. Now, why would the art world want to go back to the old view of art?
Well, I'm sure the art world or the art market, wouldn't wish to do so because it's doing very well out of the present situation.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to work out, from a philosophical point of view, what would be a rational way to proceed. And I feel that simply if we could get to using it in the same way as we use a craft, then that would be a more meaningful use of the word art, and then we could... For example, in the 16th, 17th centuries, they didn't have such things as art galleries or art museums. They had what they called cabinets of curiosities,
mm-hmm.
and people would go along and to marvel at the... It'd be a collection of, for example, of seashells or clocks or precious stones or bits of sculpture. You know, it wouldn't be advertised as a come to our art gallery or... come and see our cabinet of curiosities, and then people would go in and marvel at novelty. Then makes sense.
Okay.
People would go in to see whatever the latest novelty was somebody had thought up, that would be a legitimate thing to do, and the word art wouldn't come into it.
Well, surely art moves with the whatever the available means of production are in the society. Alex, can I just ask you to end with, we're in a postmodern stage of art, which means that there are no absolute values in art, but I'm just curious, what would you think would come after postmodernism, or where does art go from here?
I think that you can always get revivals of traditionalism. Uh-huh. I mean, somebody like Prince Charles could intervene and cause that, and that has happened a little bit in architecture and some art. I think that there's a certain amount, it depends on the market. Mark was hinting at that. Do people still have the money to spend, and is economics still going to drive the art world? There could be a reaction against that. People would say we want real skill and real technique to show.
Well, that's my feeling about art. I appreciate art which shows technique and skill and an appreciation of beauty, but I also appreciate that that's not where the art market is, which I think is somewhat of a loss to art myself. But I know I don't hold the majority view or the consensus view there. Okay, I just want to say thank you to both my guests, Mark Robert.
Thank you.
And Alex Gath. And we're going to play out with a bit of Velvet Underground now, the murder mystery. And thank you for our listeners. Next show is on the 19th of May, and this will be on Philosophy and Children with Pete Worley from the School of Philosophy. Okay, bye.